pastor for 12 years here in Long Beach at Grace Long Beach, Grace Brethren Long Beach. Currently, I am a PhD candidate. That means if I behave myself someday, they might give me a PhD at the Center for Advanced Theological Studies in Pasadena. I also teach adjunct at Talbot Seminary. And I happened to run into Chris a few weeks ago, and he said, "Hey, do you want to fill in for Pulpit Supply?" And I said, "Yes." So here I am, and I'm glad to be with you guys. I'm a different bald guy in the pulpit this morning. So I do want to talk this morning about what it means to follow Jesus Christ in the real world. And that's, you know, there's a lot of things that could mean. I want to talk a little bit about the practicality of what it means to follow Jesus in the lives that we live. There's a little popular slogan you see on bracelets and whatnot, WWJD, what would Jesus do? And I think that's a very helpful question to ask. I am in favor of changing it to WWJDIFJWMLIMW. What would Jesus do if Jesus was me living in my world? But I don't think that would fit. But that's kind of where I'm going this morning. I want to ask that question, what does it look like to follow Jesus? And if you are not a follower of Jesus this morning, I want you to feel welcome. I know this church welcomes people and loves to have visitors and people that are exploring. This is going to be a family discussion this morning. And it's actually good if you're not a Christian or you're just exploring the Christian faith, because before you join a family, you always want to know, what's it like to be in the family? Well, you get to sit down this morning and see us discuss what it means for us to be followers of Jesus in our world. And so you're welcome. We're glad you're here this morning. We do have a PowerPoint. This is the first PowerPoint talk I've ever given. I've never worn one of these things. I feel high-tech this morning. So, go ahead and put that up there. Good. So, there it is. Following Christ in today's world, how should Christians relate to culture? Go ahead and flip to the next one. How should Christians view their relationship to culture? Now, this is an interesting question. You know, it really involves so many sub-questions. And usually when you see Christians getting a little heated in discussion, behind that discussion is this bigger question. How should we relate to culture? How do we relate to Halloween? What should we do? My daughter wanted to put all kinds of scary things in front of the house for Halloween. You know, what do we do with this? How do you relate to fashion? My wife is in the fashion world. She runs showrooms in New York and L.A. She asks this question all the time. How do we relate to so-called secular music, to patriotism, to virtual reality, to public schools, to technology, to postmodern art exhibits at MoMA, to genetic research, to environmental issues? I mean, we could just go on and on and on. This is a big question. And this morning, I want to ask this the question behind all these other questions. How do we relate to culture? Go ahead and flip to the next one. In order to answer this question, we need to ask, what is culture? In what sense am I using it? And I'm not using culture in the sense of subculture or the sense of different kinds of ethnicities. I'm using it more in kind of a big sense. Culture has, there's two kind of basic standard definitions that are really the same. One's from Ken Myers. Culture is what we make of the world in both senses of the word make. Okay, think about that. It's kind of think about it for a second. We can make certain kinds of objects in the world, and we can also create ideas, all right? If you just have nature, okay, and you have man, you have no culture. But as soon as man starts to build things, as soon as man starts to create things, as soon as man starts to look at things and say what they are and begins to philosophize about the world, then you have culture. Martin Marty says this, culture is everything humans do to and make of nature. And I think that's a great definition. Flip to the next one. So, culture involves many things. It involves both things and ideas. I already talked about that. It includes artifacts, physical things we make, and ideas. Culture is also not an option. A lot of people think like, well, I just want to opt out of culture. To opt out of culture would be to walk naked into the rainforest and never be seen again. I mean, that's pretty much, you know, it's not really an option. We are going to make things in the world. We are going to have ideas about the world, okay? Culture is cumulative. This is very interesting. Maybe because I'm trippy and whatnot, but sometimes I'll just drive by and I'll look at a gas station and I'll think, all the different thinking that went into creating a gas station, you know, all the technology for, you know, the digital display and, you know, gas pumps and even just the technology of creating gas and just the generations of people thinking and creating that came into a gas station that we're just simply, you know, being able to take at that very moment. And that's true about so many things, really, as cumulative. Culture is constantly building. I'm not going to say as much as it's progressing. Technology seems to be progressing. In some ways, culture, you know, there's lots of different ways of understanding it, but it does accumulate. And finally, culture defines possibility. It gives us the horizons of the possible and the impossible, what is conceived and what is beyond our conception. If you go to Papua New Guinea, you don't ask somebody there how they want their latte, you know. That's not in their realm of possibility. Okay, so culture defines our possibility, what we can and can't do. Flip to the next slide. Great example, a cell phone, okay? All of us know this little cultural artifact, okay? What previous cultural developments does this artifact build on? We could discuss that. A whole bunch of things, okay? A bunch of different kinds of technology, right? What does this artifact assume about the way the world is? That we should always be connected, that we should be able to be reached at any given time. My wife is like, why don't you have your cell phone? I was like, I don't believe in the philosophy behind the cell phone. I have to have private space, my own space, so we'll work that out. What does this artifact assume about the way the world should be? You know, we can go through this whole thing. What does this artifact make possible and impossible? A whole bunch of things. What new culture is created in response, right? All the tweeting and all that. What future cultural developments will build on this technology? Do you see that each artifact has so many different ways of creating and producing the kind of world that we live in? The world that we live in. And I'm asking the question, what does it mean to follow Jesus in our world, the world that you live in and the world that I live in? Okay? Okay, let's go to the next slide. Now, here's my thesis. My thesis is that the Bible actually has something to say about culture. The Bible actually has something to say. And one of the angles through which you can understand the Bible is you can understand the Bible through the angle of culture. The story of the Bible is a story of culture making. If you turn to the very beginning of the Bible, in Genesis chapter 1, verse 2:1, you actually read the story of God creating the world, okay? And when we read this story, we see God taking the tohu wavohu. That's the only 3 years of Hebrew, that's all I remember, okay? Tohu wavohu, the formlessness and voidness. In the beginning, God created the world, and the world was tohu wavohu, formless and void. Okay? And God takes the tohu wavohu. If you remember that and you say that, people are going to be impressed, I'm telling you. God takes the tohu wavohu of the world, and he takes this formlessness and the emptiness and the desolateness of it, and we see that God, in the first chapter of the Bible, is doing something with the world. God is forming it, and he's filling it. Okay, go on to go back. Let's see if I got all that. We see God involved in making something in the world by bringing order and cumulative development into the world. Notice that it's a cumulative development. We don't have time to read that entire chapter this morning, but I'm assuming that most of you have that tacit knowledge of what took place in Genesis 1. God forms the world. He starts with it just formless, and you see that He cumulatively brings it to this place of completion, to where in 2:1, God stands back and says, wow, that is very good. God celebrates. He does this through forming and filling, through bringing a high level of structure and beauty into existence out of tohu or formlessness and wohu or emptiness. The pinnacle of God's creation being man made in God's likeness. There's something really important about us coming at the very end and then being made in God's likeness. We're going to look at that. Okay, now go on to the next one. Something I want you to see, okay? We oftentimes approach the story in the Bible about God creating through all of our scientific questions. You know, how exactly did this take place? And what about dating, you know, dating the different kind of, you know, carbon and blah, blah, blah. Like, I have a feeling that the person that wrote, Moses, who wrote the book of Genesis, was not obsessed with scientific questions like we are. And so it's important to allow the voice of the writer of Genesis to hit us. And I believe that if you look at the structure of what's going on here, there's a very important theological teaching. In the first 3 days, God forms. The world was tohu, formlessness, and wohu, void. And in the first 3 days, we see God creating the forms, the structures for creation. God separates light from darkness. God separates water from atmosphere. God separates water from dry land. And then in the next 3 days, God fills. God takes the light and the darkness, and God fills it with sun and moon. God takes the water and the atmosphere, and God fills it with fish and birds. God takes the dry land, the water's already been filled, and he puts animals and mankind. Do you see that structure in there? It doesn't only go down, it goes across. And so God now is taking care of the problem of tohu wabohu. God is forming and God is filling. God is bringing order and beauty into the world. Okay, next slide. Then God creates man. God involves man in the process of making something in the world. After God does this forming and filling and this cultural activity, in other words, he's engaging the world and he's making something of it, God says, let us make man in our image after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. God blessed them. God said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue, form it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the heavens, and over every living thing that moves on the earth. This whole idea of dominion that kind of rubs us wrong, you have to understand that the Bible's understanding of dominion is there's a sense of nurturing development. Okay, it says that the Lord will have dominion from sea to sea. That's actually the national motto of Canada. Oh, Canada, Psalm 72, I believe. The idea of dominion is this idea that God is nurturing and God is developing. And so God then says, I want you to do that. You've just seen me forming and filling over here. I've taken the tohu wabohu and I've made it into something very good, Genesis 2:1. Now I'm going to make man in my image, and I want him to mirror me in forming and filling and creating beauty and order in this world and making something of this world. I want you, Adama, which means earthling in the Hebrew, okay? We are earthlings. We are Adama. We are of the earth. Okay, we Adam means earth. We are earthlings. Okay, we are those of the earth. Okay, you earthlings, God says. I remember at Vacation Bible School, some kid said, "I had a great time at Long Beach Aliens Church." You earthlings, okay? Like, we're not aliens. God put us here on the earth. This is where we belong. This is our home. All right, you earthlings, I want you to mirror me in making something of this world. Okay, are you guys connecting with this? All right, I don't want to go too fast, too slow. Okay, I got one amen or at least a yes. That's close. I'll take that. All right, let's move forward. Okay, this command that God says, okay, I want you to fill the earth and I want you to subdue it. This has been referred to as the cultural mandate, bum, ba, bum, by Christians for centuries. And what that means is that within this command, God is implicitly telling man he should be about the task of making culture. Isn't that cool? How many of you ever heard this before? I'm curious. You know, I'd been a Christian a long time. I never recognized this before. So what does it mean? Some observations. To be in God's likeness means to be engaged in forming and filling. It is to be. It is to create and cultivate order and beauty in the world. Interesting. To have dominion is to imitate God in his nurturing, creative, cumulative, governing relationship to the world. There's Psalm 72:8, O Canada. God calls the first couple to multiply so they can fill and form. They are to procreate in order to co-create. Pretty cool. How in the world are you going to fill this world and form it if it's you and your hubby? Like, a big job, you know. We're going to need more people in order to do that. So God has them multiply. All right, next slide. All right. In Genesis 2, God now, we turn now to to a completely different setting, all right? If you know the biblical story, it moves now, kind of focuses in on the garden. And in the garden, we see God giving man a very different, a little bit more, not very different, but a little more nuanced understanding of his commission, of his calling. In Genesis 2, we see God wants man to continue in the cultural project through the task of cultivating. Genesis 1, man is called to create, to form, and to fill. In Genesis 2, there's this issue of cultivation. They are to cultivate the garden, and this is the command that God gives them. He sets them in the garden to cultivate it, okay? Now, there's a little difference. I mean, it's not a big deal, but if this is a Sunday school class, I'd break into groups and have you answer the question, what is the difference between cultivating and creating? But we see both of those focuses in the first two chapters. Go to the next slide. Okay. This is the first command. I want you to notice that in Genesis 1:26, the cultural mandate is the first command given to man. It's the very first one in the Bible, okay? It took place before the fall. If you know the story of the Bible, you have God creates, then you have the fall, then and that's in Genesis chapter 3, and then you have this whole thing. I mean, it's just a giant, the bulk of the Bible is God is in this act of redeeming mankind. And then at the end, you have the final consummation, which God finally brings the new heaven and the new earth. That's a real simple, if you're looking for a shorthand of what the Bible's about, it's really four chapters, okay? We've gone to the first chapter, okay? God creates, forms man, commissions man to be also engaged in this world, creating and cultivating this world. Then there's the fall. And the question comes up, how will the fall impact man's job of creating culture? That's where you're at in the story. Suddenly, like, okay, well, what's going to happen here with this command that man has, okay? Flip to the next slide. Even with evil in the world, mankind fulfills the cultural mandate. Let me kind of substantiate that with the Bible. If you look at Genesis chapter 4, it says that Cain's descendants actually engage in culture making. Genesis chapter 4, I think it's 6 and 7 and maybe in 9, it says that that Cain's descendants become makers of instruments, that they begin to develop metal, and then it says, and they build a city. A city, by the way, is a conglomeration of culture. There's lots and lots of things that man has made, and there's lots of ideas. And so what we see happening in the Bible is that God commissioned man to be a culture maker. Man falls, but then God's commission still continues on with broken man engaged in this. The world is continuing to create culture. Man cannot escape this fundamental job that God gave him to do as Adamah, as earthlings. And so what's the point? Mankind must obey God's law, God's command to make culture, even if he doesn't want to. You ever think about that? We don't really break God's law. Okay? God's law breaks us. God's law is so much a part of the fabric of the universe. God said, let there be gravity, and there's gravity. You say, well, you know, I'm sorry, I'm going to break that one. No, you're not going to break the law of gravity. Gravity's going to break you. You have to obey it. And the Bible has this theme throughout it. And I think that's true with culture making. God has commanded man to make things of this world, and he does it. Culture is a mixture of sin and grace, though. Right? It's this interesting conglomeration. What fallen man continues to produce, it's always this interesting mixture of sin and grace. And finally, the God-given cultural project is carried forward by fallen humanity. I think I already said that. But what's the result? Let's flip to the next slide. This is the result. The result is something we all know. That you can have something good, good structure, good things in this world that can be taken in a wrong direction. Architecture is a great thing. This is a great building. I like this building a lot. I like that it's got a high roof line. It draws our eyes up. We have a feeling of that we're not in a flat plane, but that there's a whole other element to the world. Okay? There's another world, so to speak, beyond the level of earth. There's the heavens. There's a place in which God dwells, the scripture talks about. I think God also dwells here. But there's something unique about recognizing that this world is larger than the earth and just what we can see in our own plane of sight. And this architecture brings that out, okay? Now, I go to New York a lot because my wife has an office there. And there's a lot of churches, sadly, in New York that have been turned into, like, you know, lounges and dance clubs and whatnot. And bad things happen in those buildings, okay? That architecture is not good, used for good things, all right? This architecture is being used for something good. It's being given a good direction. Fire is good. Okay, but it can be given a wrong direction. Sex is good, but outside of God's context, it can be given a wrong direction and be destructive. Okay, so we see that the cultural project, the things that man makes, the technology that man has, it's a good thing, but it can be given a wrong direction. Let's flip to the next one. Okay, the story of the Bible can be seen as God's redemptive project to fulfill the original cultural mandate. It's a movement from the garden to the city. And if we look at the end of the Bible, what we find is that man is not placed back into a garden, but what happens at the end of the Bible? What comes out of heaven down to earth? The New Jerusalem. A Jerusalem is a city. It's a cultural conglomeration. We are not, the whole goal of Christianity is not for us to get back to where we're just sitting with fig leaves, you know, or without fig leaves, I guess, right? That's not the goal. The goal is for us to continue in this project, but to do it in a way that is under the lordship of God. The New Jerusalem is a place in which God dwells in the middle of her. And so our culture producing should be something that one day God will be intimately engaged with and dwell in the middle of. Next slide. So fallen Christ. How should Christians view the relationship to culture? What should be our posture? That's what I set off with, right? That's where we're going, right? Okay, let's kind of get a little more practical here. That was a little biblical theology of culture. That was just like, you know, a thumbnail for you. Okay, I'm doing a PhD in theology and culture. I got way more to say about that than you would even care to know. All right, but that was a little thumbnail sketch. Okay, now let's ask the practical question. What does it mean to follow Christ in the world that we live in? Okay, how do we engage with it? Let's talk a little bit about, I'm going to use a helpful metaphor. Okay, gestures and postures. Flip to the next slide. A gesture is an action or a response. Some include hunching, smiling, waving. There's lots of different gestures, okay? But a posture is a particular frozen kind of state that comes as a result of the repetition of certain gestures. So if I'm always, you know, walking, you know, if I like to, like, for instance, I can give you one. My dad passed down this wonderful gesture that's become a posture. I have a grimace. My wife makes fun of it. It's like, she's like, you're not really happy. You actually have a painful smile. I'm like, oh, I do? I don't know. It's just something that happens. It's a posture I have. It's something, it's a thing I have. You know, I can't get rid of it. I see it in pictures like, there it is again. Dang it. You know, there's lots of different postures. We can go into this, but there's lots of different postures we can create because of gestures, all right? Flip to the next slide. I want to look at four different possible gestures we can have towards culture, okay, and possible postures as well. And the first one is that you see out there a lot is Christians have the gesture or posture of condemning. Now, when we look at what's going on in the world and the different cultural artifacts, you know, the U2 concert that's tonight, I don't know where you're going, you know, different things that are being created. I guess they're $2 million just for every setup of that show. I mean, that's a lot of culture producing. 95,000 people streaming the Rose Bowl tonight. I'm one of them. But when we look at these different acts, these different culture, what do we do? What do we do with the things, with the culture out there? Well, one possible approach is to condemn. And as a gesture, I think that we would say that there are some cultural artifacts and movements that can only be condemned. You know, gangs, you know, pornography, prostitution. The right response to this is to condemn this, okay? And so there are many things that we should condemn. But as a posture, when that is our posture as Christians, okay, and that's our predominant way of interacting with culture, we become suspicious and we withdraw from culture. We don't go to U2 concerts. You know, we separate ourselves from the world around us. And you'll see that for certain Christian groups, sometimes this becomes their predominant posture. And the entire world is seen as an us versus them mentality. Usually groups that become very, very legalistic have a fundamental posture of condemning culture. There's nothing good. It's all bad. You know, I remember hearing about this older lady who, you know, she just said, you know, her favorite verse in the Bible was, man was born to afflictions like the sparks fly upward or something. I was like, wow, that's a real winner. Like, hey, you know, that's one way of looking at the world. You know, you want a little more sugar in your tea, grandma? You know, I mean, like, okay, so that's one gesture slash posture. Another approach to culture, let's flip to the next one, is critique. Critique as a gesture recognizes that culture is a valuable dialogue partner. It's something that offers us an access to the reigning philosophies. For instance, critique is actually a very good posture to have with particular kinds of cultural artifacts, fine art. You go to a museum, you go there to critique. Okay, philosophy. You're going to critique. Independent films, you're going to critique. Novels. Critique is a good gesture to have. Okay, but as a posture, if that's our fundamental posture, critique does not participate in cultural creativity. It tends to produce cultural critics rather than culture makers. And so, you know, there was a movement called Le Bris in the 70s, Francis Schaeffer. It was all about the critique. And that's a great thing. We need to learn how to critique culture. We need to understand what's going on, the reigning philosophies, what people are believing. But if that's our fundamental posture, we're never going to produce anything. We're just going to be critics. Okay, go to the next one. The next way we can approach culture is copying. And copying is where we just simply see what's out there, and we just take it, and we maybe rip out, you know, whatever words are associated. We stuff Jesus in there, and we use it, okay? And there is a time and place to copy, all right? There are things that are worth copying. I don't think that any one of us has not learned through copying. And most of us, that's what we do. And so sometimes there's a point for copying. However, as a posture, copying tends to give an uncritical welcome and embrace of cultural forms. In Christian contemporary music, there was this time where the whole idea was that you had to have a Jesus quotient. So you'd listen to a song, there's a certain kind of style, and Christian artists would then copy that style, and they would just make sure they said Jesus a bunch in the song, and that was a Christian hit. Okay? And it was like, really? And what that meant was that Christian music always was about 2 or 3 years behind what was really happening in culture, which made you, if you were into Christian music, always feel like you're a little late to the party. And so artists do copy. They do learn from each other, but copying as a fundamental posture is problematic. One more. Flip to the next one. Consuming. The gesture of consuming cuts out the Christian middleman, goes straight to the source. And there are certain cultural goods and services that should be consumed. My watch. I like this watch, okay? I consumed this watch. I went to the store, I saw it, and I bought it. I didn't create it. I go, honey, I'm taking the year off. I'm going to build a watch. I'm going to learn how it all works. You know, I'll be back a year from now. No, our home. We consumed our home. I went on the market, bought it. You know, I could have, 10 years. I don't know how long it took me to build a house, but I just consumed it. Okay? But when that's our fundamental posture as of consumers, then for Christians, we end up looking just like fellow Americans. And I would say that the present-day evangelical movement, this is our fundamental posture towards culture. If there's any criticism, this is our fundamental posture. And if we're going to be salt and light in this world and make a difference in this world, we can't just be consumers. We have to engage and actually be something more than that. Okay, let's flip to the next one. Little review. While condemning, critiquing, copying, consuming are all appropriate gestures, they make for a poor posture. That's the lesson. Condemning as a posture closes us from the beauty as well as grace and mercy in many cultural forms. God is at work in places outside of the church, and we can piggyback on that and actually bring the gospel to bear on those things. Critiquing as a posture, while an improvement on condemning, leaves us strangely passive and unable to simply enjoy a cultural good. Rather than interrogating, I remember being with people that are really into the Schaefer thing. It's like every single film, like, what worldview is behind this film? It's like, I don't know. I just thought it was a cool film. I liked it, you know. And there is a time to enjoy other elements besides the worldview behind whatever cultural product. Copying as a posture ends up creating a Christian subculture that is slightly behind and prefers facsimile to reality, imitation to authenticity, simplicity to complexity, which is always what happens when you copy. And finally, consuming as a posture requires time and energy to pay attention to our preferences, leaving us believing we are the most human when we are purchasing something someone else has made. And that's a danger. I don't know if you ever spent a whole day, like my wife and I were looking for a fridge recently. It's like, well, gosh, what? You know, after 3 days in appliance stores, you're like, what fridge really is us? Like, wait, there's something bigger to life than what fridge is us. Like, you know what I'm saying? There's more. This is a refrigerator. We need to keep our food cold so we can eat, you know? But consuming can wrap you into that, you know? And you're just so about knowing all of your preferences. And that's the consuming approach. Okay, let's move on here. How am I doing on time? I think I'm okay. All right. Cultivation, the art of culture keeping. In Genesis 2, man is called to cultivate the ground. To cultivate is to preserve a cultural good. It's to create the most fertile environment for something to thrive. As such, it involves disciplines, weeding, watering, attending to. Learning languages, learning the rules of baseball, learning medicine, becoming a chef, practicing the piano, making a healthy dinner. I would say raising children. Okay, that's a big act of cultivation. All right, these are all activities of cultivation. None of these are creating per se. Yet they are all means by which we cultivate cultural goods that image the very good shalom of Genesis 2:1. We are called to be cultivators of culture. That's our fundamental posture. Genesis 2, God places man in the garden. What is the garden? The garden is not just nature. A garden is nature plus culture. Isn't that interesting? God is the first culture maker in the Bible. Okay? So man is in there. God has already shown them that this is a cultural place. And he says, I want you to cultivate that culture. The very word cultivate comes from the word culture, right? It's to bring forth the potentiality. And many of you live lives and you think, what is the connection between the fact that I've gone to law school and I've learned the rules of law, or I've learned the rules of medicine, or I'm practicing this, or I'm practicing that, or I work as in whatever kind of vocation, I've learned these particular trades, and now I'm cultivating this particular trade. And you know what the connection is? Is you're obeying God's command in Genesis chapter 2. Isn't that cool? People say, like, what should I do as a Christian at work? You should definitely tell people about Jesus. You should definitely not do immoral things. But you know what you should also do? You should be really good at your work. You should do a great job cultivating whatever it is that your vocation or your skill has called you to. And people, when they see your skill, they say, wow, you're obeying Genesis 2. Wow, good job. You're cultivating your garden. Good job. Okay, let's go on to the next one. The other major posture we should have is creating. Imaging our creative God. We have a creative God. And one of the ways in which we image God is through creating things for this world, creating ideas. I just recently published an article on a theology of fashion. My wife is in the fashion industry. I'm like, all right, how does a Christian think about fashion? Okay, so I published this article. No one's ever wrote on, it's actually a Kuyperian theology. I'm using this one theologian, understand his system, apply it to issues in fashion, and I've created this thing. It's like, wow, this is a whole new dialogue. And I've presented it. I had a bunch of Christian people over in the fashion industry. I said, let's talk about your trade. Let's talk about what it means to be obeying God in your industry. And, you know, there's something about producing this set of ideas that haven't been kind of put together before that is just really, I felt like I was really in touch with who God's called me to be. And when you're creating, you feel a sense of being who God has called you to be, because you are Adama and you've been given a command to mimic our God, who brings order and beauty out of things that are unformed and unfilled. And some of you have incredible creativity. And most of us are called to cultivate. And oftentimes, it's only once you've cultivated something for a long time that you actually can be in the place to create. That's usually the way it works, right? It's not like when you're just starting off as an artist, usually copying and learning the skills and learning the rules of how it works. But after you've done that and had the disciplines for a number of years, then you can create. And both of these are fundamental postures that we should have as Christians. This is what God has called us to do. We are called to create culture. We are called to go out there, and this is Christ's world. There's not one square inch of this world that Jesus doesn't say, this is mine. I made it. I made it with all of its potentialities. I made it with all, Jesus, when he made the world, he knew that there was a potential for cell phones. He made the world so cell phones could be created, and so TVs could be created. And so the technology we have yet to invent could be invented. This is his world, and he calls us to embrace it as our own and to choose to say, yes, Jesus, I'm going to take ownership of being a human being. And when Jesus comes, I love, there's a bumper sticker out there, not of this world. If some of you have that bumper sticker, I get where you're going with that. We are called to be different from the culture around us, okay? But we are actually of this world. Jesus said, okay, to be in the world but not of it. Okay. By the world there, he does not mean this world, okay? He means rebellious humanity operating irregardless of what Jesus thinks. We are to be very concerned what Jesus thinks, but this is our home, and this is where we're called to serve God in the very practicality of our lives, which most of our lives are pretty mundane, right? A lot of cultivating your teeth, all right? Make sure they don't fall out, I'll brush them. I mean, when you're a parent, you realize that an awful lot of life is cultivating, right? The majority of your life, but just life, this, the mundaneness of life, this is okay. God has called us this. It doesn't mean that it's all good. It's broken. Obviously, it's difficult. One day we will live in a new earth in which we won't have a lot of the curse, but it won't be that we'll be beamed up and be aliens, Long Beach aliens. So, all right, let's flip to the last slide. Okay, so we are called. There is a vocation to create and cultivate, imitate our creating and cultivating God. Okay, Genesis 1 and 2. While condemning, critiquing, copying, and consuming are appropriate at times, they are not to be our calling as creators and cultivators. All right? Creating culture brings sustainable cultural change. I didn't really emphasize this, but I want to say this. Christians too much complain about the culture out there. If you study culture, one of the things you find out is that culture exists continuously in a state where there are no vacuums. Okay, what that means is that there aren't, it's not just like culture continues to produce. There will be culture produced. If there is a gap of people's attention, somebody will fill it. If there's something to be developed, somebody will develop it. And so instead of complaining about the films that are out there in Hollywood, we can complain, but until we go out and produce films, you know, we're not going to change anything. We're just going to be complainers sitting on the sideline. Well, you know, they should do something different here. I don't like this one. I don't like that one. I don't like this one. Well, get up and do something. And so as Christians, we're called to create, and that's the way that we change the world around us, is we actually get engaged. If you don't like the way your secular public school is going, get on the PTA. Be a salt and light and see transformation. If you don't like something out there, create. That's our calling. And then finally, creating and cultivating culture is something, I don't know, I lost it. It's a practical way to love our neighbor. You know, I thank God every day for all the practical ways that people have labored, even people that don't know Christ, in order to bring goods into our lives. Just making breakfast this morning, like, wow, I can just open this thing called a refrigerator. I got a frying pan. I didn't invent the frying pan, the refrigerator. These are all good things I'm getting, you know. And as Christians, there is something about producing good and beauty in the world as a way of loving our neighbor, you know, second command. Okay, finally, let's wrap it all up. I just want to end with these two questions. Next slide. What are you called to create? What are you called to cultivate? And where is your heart with that? Let's kind of bring it down the level. Where is your heart with that? Some of you, God has called you to do something more with your life than just survive between now and the time you die. Some of you have been given incredible, incredible responsibilities of cultivating something. I want to ask, is that a burden? Bring it to Jesus because he's called you to do that to his glory. Maybe that's your job. Maybe that's at home. Maybe that's a relationship. You know what that is, but what is it that God has put on your plate to cultivate? What is it he's put on your plate to create? And I want us to embrace these underneath the lordship of Jesus and go for it. And I'd love to see this church, and I'd love to see, you know, all the churches in Long Beach, and I'd love to see the churches around the globe really being a force in this world, because that's how we'll be salt and light, is when we follow our God and his calling for us to be creators and for us to be cultivators. Let's pray.